Welcome to the Pop-Up Pod, a sporadic podcast that pops up a few times a year to dive deep into life's most common and interesting questions. The question we've been exploring all throughout season one is this: should I get married? 12 episodes, 12 different people, honest conversations about the joys and struggles of long-term romantic relationships. I'm your host, Nicole Antoinette, and these intimate conversations are 100% listener-funded, paid for by my sliding scale Patreon community. That means that you won't hear any ads or sponsors on this show. It's just me, backed by the support of over 400 people who have come together to ensure that everyone involved in making this podcast gets paid. That includes me as the host and creator, my sound engineer and musician and good friend, Adam Day, as well as every single one of our guests. Our Patreon community also funds the creation of a full transcript for each episode, which you can find in the show notes to help make these conversations more accessible. Those are our production ethics here at the Pop-Up Pod, and if that aligns with your own values, I would love to invite you to come check out our community at patreon.com/NicoleAntoinette. It's a fun and easy and welcoming space, and remember that it's run on a sliding scale, so you can pay whatever amount makes most sense for you, either as a monthly payment or an annual payment, and you will get access to a wealth of bonus content. You'll get the chance to help shape the topics and conversations of future seasons, and more. So one more time, that's patreon.com/NicoleAntoinette, and hopefully I'll see you there. In the meantime, I'm excited to introduce you to today's guest, Holly Whitaker. Holly, whose pronouns are she, her, joins us today to talk about her experience of being mostly single over the past 10 years. She shares honestly about what it's like to really want a partner, to feel like you're missing out by not having one, and yet to somehow also know that you aren't ready. It's so, so good, everything that she shares. The conversation's filled with wonderful nuance and with us each holding space for the both and of life, where seemingly contradictory things are true at the exact same time. And you might be able to hear that my voice is a little off today. I'm recovering from a sinus infection that's got me all congested. So sorry about that, but here we go. Okay, here we go, my dear. Holly, welcome to the show.
Thank you. This is like, I think, the favorite podcast I've ever done twice. So let's go for three. I love talking to you. And
thank
I'm really
you.
Honored.
Every podcast I start, I'm just bringing you along with me. So thanks for being along for
I'll
the ride.
I'll do them all. Yeah. Great. No, I really appreciate it. And this topic is so important and interesting. And yeah.
Then let's start with a question I've been asking everyone: for you to introduce yourself with your relationship bio. So less what do you do and more of a who and how do you love? Basically, like, how do you want to situate yourself for this conversation that we're going to have?
Yeah. So my name is Holly Whitaker. I think something that's really important to understand is that I'm recently out and I don't really know how to define that yet just because it is so new to me. So I'm 43 and I'm still figuring out, you know, what my sexual preference is. And I have been relationship crazy since I was a baby. And since I made out with my next door neighbor when I was 5 years old. Like, we used to make out, we would hide and make out. I have always been somebody that I wouldn't say is sexually charged, but is absolutely romantically charged. And loves love. And I have been chasing it I had boyfriends very early. I had sex relatively early, or not sex, but I think like I've always wanted to have that kind of intimacy. It's always been really important to me. And I would say I was a serial monogamist until I got sober. And for the last decade, I have been sober and I've mostly been, I feel like, learning all over again. Like, I feel like when I got sober, I became – the way I connected romantically was very, very it was like I was 5 years old and making out with Gabriel Mirazza all over again and just out of my mind. And it has been a really interesting decade, and I have not been in – I've had relationships, but I haven't been in what feels like a relationship, like a really solid relationship in about a decade. You know, mm-hmm. I've had some things, but nothing that feels of substance or that feels like I, you know, like I could point to that and say that was a real relationship. So I'm 43 and I'm single and I've had to, you know, really learn what that means. And I have gotten the chance to really like think about how I feel about sex, who I want to be in relationship with. And that's where I'll leave it. Is that, how's that?
That's fantastic. I want to ask you 1,000 more questions. So congratulations on a successful introduction.
Woo! Okay, good. All right.
So when you were describing this feeling of like chasing love or like chasing intimacy, can you say a little bit more about like, what is it that you're actually chasing? Like, what did you want out of that? Or what do you want?
Well, I think it's always changed, right? I think over the years, it has just, there's nothing better than being newly in love. There is nothing better than that feeling of like wanting, right? Of longing. And I think that my first taste of wanting and longing was Gabriel. And like, he was the neighbor on my block and I just wanted him. And then there was Sean Van Sickle. I remember their names. I don't remember many people's names, right? And I remember these boys' names. And I think like, what I wanted was, honestly, I think validation. I think that as a woman or as a girl, I was absolutely indoctrinated into this idea that the male gaze and how you appear in the male gaze is what establishes your value. So I think that it has been that like that being recognized by other, and it's changed over the years. And but I'm still chasing it because I love love. I am such a porous person, and which means I feel things extraordinarily. And to me, it's like I get swept up in that sense of you know, what I would now call, you know, used to be like the sense of like completion by another. And now I would say is more of just like mutual celebration. And what that's what I'm looking for, but it still is that connection with another person that goes beyond what to me personally is available in friendship. Mm-hmm. And I think that there is a lot of ways that people can find that intimacy that span the definition of relationship. But for me, it still comes back to that's the thing I want. I want my person and I want that, like, I want my love story. And I'm much more grown up now and realize a lot more things about myself. But I still, when it comes down to it, I still want my love story. It just looks different.
What do you think it looks like now?
I think it is like what I was saying before. I think before I thought I needed someone else for my life to be good. I needed someone else to validate me, to recognize me, to complete me, to like to fill up the, to plug up the holes. And now it's just more of like a partner to explore life with, just somebody to witness it with me, not to witness me, sure, to see me, but also I think like as it's just different. It's a different kind of longing, right?
Do you have, and this might be too vague of a question, but do you have a memory of when it changed for you from wanting like that validation and someone to complete you versus what you just described as what you want right now? Like, was there something that happened where you were like, hang on, why am I looking for someone to complete me? Is there something you can point to that was like a fork in the road?
No. I mean, it's interesting because I had all of my relationships prior to getting sober were very much about like, they were contracts, you know, I'll do this for you if you do this for me. And I was always at the mercy of my partner. And when I got sober, it was like there was a period of time of just like wanting to not, I don't know. Like, it's so hard to explain because it wasn't like that. It was just a very slow change. I think it's like you read stuff and you start like, you know, like you get sober, you're in recovery, you start to have like a self-awareness you didn't have before. You start to see your patterns, the same patterns you had with drinking or with drugs show up in behaviors and like how you, you know, obsess or compulsive around another person or how much you are dependent on another person's actions for you. You just start to notice these things like, oh shit, I'm not okay unless this person has sent me a text message with these right words, or this person is doing this, or you start to notice the ways that your self-worth have been totally, like I had no self-worth at the beginning of this. And the ways that my self-worth were completely dependent on how men treated me. And I saw how little I settled for. And so I think like the self-awareness around my value, my standards, my boundaries, and also just my own behavior, right? What I expect of myself. It's very different when you're showing up and you're so grown up around your relationship with alcohol. Like I feel very mature when it comes to that decision. But it's like an intelligence, right? Like there's multiple intelligences. And I think like my intelligence around certain things are very high. And I think my intelligence around intimate love, or let's just say, yeah, like a relational love, was very low. And so I think that I'm really far off the question that you asked me, but what I'm trying to say is, it flipped because I did the work on myself and I could start to see what I was doing. Mm-hmm. And I knew it didn't feel good. And I read a lot of stuff that made sense to me, like Marianne Williamson talking about, or like not Marianne Williamson, but A Course in Miracles talking about, you know, like the special person, the special relationship, which is like where you define, you know, like the special relationship is elevating this other person above other people to say like this one person will do this thing for me. And it doesn't exist, right? Like that doesn't exist. What does exist is the way that we find other people in order to, not to make us better, but in order to, you know, essentially like they call in Course in Miracles, it's the holy relationship. And it's just like two people come together to create. Mm-hmm. Two people don't come together to fill a deficit within the other. And like I knew that intelligently, but I didn't know that experientially. And I think that it's just the intelligence and the experience have lined up and lined up and lined up and lined up until it got to the point where I can actually say to you, I know that the next person that I'm with, both of us are going to be in the place where we know we're coming together to be with each other, but also to not, you know, make each other whole.
Mm-hmm. And what you're saying is making me reflect a little bit on my own relationship history. And I don't know that I would say that I was ever looking for someone to complete me, but I definitely was looking for this particular kind of validation that comes from being like chosen by some dude.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. The like, you're special, you're wanted, I pick you to be my girlfriend. And it's been a really interesting reckoning through doing this podcast, to be honest, has made me like, of course, like when you're recording episode after episode, that's like a deep dive into relationships, it makes you surprised, think about your own relationship history. And like really sort of grappling with the relationships that I was in or that I stayed in that I didn't even really like the person, or I didn't like who I was with them, but it just like felt so good to be chosen and to not have to like do the labor of dating. And I thought it like made me special. I'm not proud of any of this. Like this all feels gross to say out loud, but yeah, that there were so many times where I'm like, man, I think I would have benefited from spending more time alone or being unpartnered at those points in my life. And I am trying to have a lot of compassion, but also I have sadness for my, you know, like younger self, particularly in my like early to mid 20s, where I'm like, why were you just like so obsessed with being picked?
Oh my God. I mean, first of all, I feel that like, you know, like a sonic boom, right? Like it just like reverberates because I know exactly what you mean. It's interesting. One of my friends says it just flipped for her one time where she realized she was thinking, does he like me? And like worried about, does he like me? And then she was like, I don't like him, you know? And I think that it was such a thing. Like it was like a lightning bolt to her to consider what she like, because her first filter is, do you like me? And not do I like you? Mm-hmm. And I think that's extremely common for women. I don't know. Don't you?
Yeah. No, I mean, I definitely do. It's, yeah, we're raised that way, right?
We're raised that way.
Just, I mean, look at like every, I mean, maybe not currently, but like the sort of rom-com culture that I grew up on, or like the Disney yes. princess culture that I grew up on, right? There really was that feeling of this person picks you and then they provide for you and then you're safe and you're worthy and you've like reached kind of the high of this, you know, relationship escalator or this pinnacle or whatever, and people don't have to worry about you, that there's something wrong with you, that people didn't pick you, which all is well, fucked it up, is but
always about, it's always about, I mean, it's always hetero and it's always about the male picking the woman.
Yep.
Or about the woman transforming into the one that could be picked. It's always through the male gaze. But I also think, like, I want to go back to one thing that you just said too, which is like, it's, you said it's gross. And this was a turning point for me. So I was dating somebody and he just, you know, I'm an anxious attached, and he was an avoidant. And without getting into attachment styles, let's just say that's just like the two, that like the opposite ends of the battery. They're just like, it's a terrible combination, but he was not into me and I was so into him. And this was like late 2017. And we're now really good friends. Hi, Jordan. But like,
I like all the name dropping you're doing of like, this was the person I kissed when I was 5 years old. Name dropping. Okay, it's great. It's great.
I know. That's funny. No, I mean, he's always, whatever. He's always asking to be named in my work. So there you go, Jordan. Anyway, we were dating and I was really into him and he was not into me. And I was acting like such a fucking freak about it. It just like, it imploded me. And I was watching myself because it's late 2017. I don't know how many years sober. I had just raised like $2 million for my recovery company. And I think this part of me was so fucked up still. And I remember thinking, I was like obsessing about texting him. I lost a ton of weight. You know what I mean? My whole world got so, I'm raising money for a company. And also I think I had just gotten like my agent contract for my first book. My whole world focus was on his text message response.
Oh my God. It's so real. The like is so successful, right? In other areas of your life. And then how does it become like boiled
and
down to like,
all I can think about is why isn't he texting me back, and what I'm going to say. And like my whole world hinged on his responses to me. And I remember talking to my therapist at the time about it. And I was just like, I was so disgusting to myself and so embarrassed of myself. And she was like, first of all, this is a really beautiful part of you. Do you see that this part of you that's willing to take risks, this part of you that is so open and so willing to be vulnerable, and that this idea that you are the weird one or the really sick one or the weak one or the dumb one, and all these thoughts I had about myself, because that nothing made me feel worse than running after men. Nothing made me feel smaller or more unattractive or just fucking like a piece of shit. And I did start to understand that in that moment and appreciate the girl that sent the crazy text message to this guy that was so obviously not interested in her, and that like kept doing it and was like getting, you know, like was electrified by it. And when I look back to that too, and I think about how I am now, I wouldn't fucking do that again. But I did that 100 times, you know, like 100 times at least, acted, you know, with like different people that I met online that I was trying to date in the last 10 years. And I had to go through that. And I had to kind of like almost like burn off that karma, I guess you could say, or like work out that behavioral pattern and keep making these tiny little adjustments. And I think so often that we're so hard on ourselves for being where we're at. And I know that what made it the worst was how embarrassed I was of myself. Mm-hmm. And I think, but there's no other way I could have. You don't get to like just not take the staircase. You know, you don't get to just like bypass the growth you have to go through to learn the things you need to learn. And so for me, the turning point was accepting where I was at and being really nice to myself about it, or trying to be really nice to myself about it, and trying not to think I was a fucking like ogre because of it.
Yeah. And also at the same time, it's important for me to internalize that any sort of growth and like the evolution that you're talking about, in my experience, hasn't been linear, meaning that I will get to a point where I'm like, I thought I was over this, or I thought, you know, this behavior was done for me, or, you know, for me, it pings a lot on like this fear of being too much, right? Like too intense, too big of feelings, too needy, right? All of that. That's like,
girl, me too.
Right. Which is either the too much, not enough, which may, you know, maybe that's the same thing, I think, is a part of a lot of people's story. For me, it always manifested, especially in relationships with, you know, wanting to act like the cool girl and like not be too much. And there was a lot of healing that I have done around that. And I have come so far, and still a regular part of my current partnership, because the person I'm in partnership with, he also has that wounding around being too much, being too emotional, being, you know, like thinking that he's too needy. And it's like part of our practice. Hey, can you like reassure me that I'm not too much, right? Can you tell me that I'm not being too much? And like that, when we first started doing that, I was like, ugh, what's wrong with me that I need this, right? Isn't this something that I'm over already? And it's, I just have to keep remembering that, like, yes, you grow. Yes, maybe you don't respond the same way that you would have responded 5 years ago or 10 years ago. And yet, like, it is sort of not the like two steps forward, one step back. I don't even mean that, but the things just kind of come up in different ways. And it's like when I expect that I've reached this like pedestal point of healing, that's when I usually wind up getting really knocked on my ass.
Yeah. No, I mean, I appreciate you bringing that up, because I think that I'm in a place right now where I feel really good, you know, about myself. But also, you're exactly right, which is that these behaviors are ingrained, they're a lifetime in, you know, like I'm, you know, not just my own lifetime, but like my ancestral lifetime, you know, like all the women that came before me, you know, under patriarchy have essentially existed, you know, as the thing made out of Adam's rib to exist for Adam, right? And so I think that undoing this stuff is really hard. And when I think I am past something and then I engage in that same behavior, it is probably one of the most demoralizing things you can go through, because you're just so exhausted by yourself and you've done all the work and then you're doing that same fucking old tired pattern again. So yeah, I appreciate you bringing that up, because that's also true. It's not linear, but it is where I'm at now. And I have to remember this in a moment of strength is so different. I've never felt the way that I feel today. You know, in all the years of my life. Man, that feels good.
Yeah. So I want to talk a little bit about expectations versus reality, because the way that you were describing, you know, who you were growing up, who you were in your 20s, maybe like even in your 30s, this kind of like chasing and really wanting the love or wanting the relationships and maybe not finding the kinds of relationships that you wanted. Do you feel like you held an expectation or a set of expectations of what your relational life would look like by, you know, a certain age, or by 30, yeah, by 35, by 40? Like, did you have a clear picture that has turned out to be different from what has happened? I'm always interested in people digging into the gap between like the fantasy of the thing and the reality of the thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think I gave that up when, you know, I was with somebody that I was, that I thought I was in love with. I set my sights on him and I was like, you're the one, you know, and he was a lawyer and came from a, you know, a good family. And by that, I mean wealthy, you know, and like he went to an Ivy League school, and it was exactly in my mind what I thought my life should look like, right? Which was being his wife. I wanted to have many children with him. And that, like, that was my goal, was to become someone's wife, as if I had fucking gone to college just to meet a man, you know, like women did in, you know, the 50s. And when that fell apart, that was like really what escalated my addiction. And I was probably 29, 30 when that fell apart. I was 30 when that fell apart. And I think that that dissolved my expectations for myself. And I don't know if I ever reclaimed them. And for me, I had a boyfriend of like for 7 years right out of high school, you know, through my, you know, through my first part of my career. And he and I had a miscarriage. We were living together and we were going to get married and we were going to have this baby. And it was, you know, I'd had an abortion. This was the second time getting pregnant by him over that time. And when that happened, that just kind of planted the seed of like knowing I wanted to be a mother and knowing I wanted to like that was a really important part of my identity. And I think that it's all, that was like my focus from my early 20s until my you know, early 30s. And then when that fell apart in my early 30s, it was almost like I'd aged out of it. And then I was struggling with a really, really like with multiple addictions and thinking I was going to die. And then I somehow didn't die. And I was so focused for so long on that part of my recovery that was really important. And I think that, I guess what I'm trying to say is I had very traditional and typical, you know, heterosexual, like upper class expectations. And then that died. And then it just in some way feels like I just recently started to want a family again. Mm-hmm. And like I wanted it in my early 20s, you know, just like desperately. And I almost feel like I was crying about this to my mom a couple days ago, and I don't know if I'm saying this exactly right, but like I was, you know, like I have like, you know, like chronic hair loss, not like genetic hair loss, but chronic hair loss. And I was crying about like losing my hair and having hearing loss and being the sober bitch and like, you know, in my 40s and like my mom is disabled. And I was like, you understand this. You just don't want one more thing to count against you as a viable person that is dateable or lovable. And I'm like paying a lot of money to like figure out how to not fucking lose my hair because I just don't think I will live through it. And I said, I think I just, and I started crying, and it's like, it's this, I think that like part, what I guess what I'm trying to express is for 10 years, I really didn't have any expectations for any of this. Mm-hmm. I've wanted it, but I had no expectations of it. And I think that that's what feels the hardest.
Yeah.
Is almost the, you know, like we're raised to like dream of these ideas of what like a relationship or a family is. And I think there's like, there's this part where I think a lot of us who maybe started out with that, you know, because there's plenty of people that just never wanted that. But I think for those of us who it didn't come to pass for, there's that original heartbreak. And I think like the heartbreak I'm trying to describe right now is like, the years in which it was still possible in my mind, you know, like possible to be like to, you know, to reproduce or whatever. It just wasn't a priority. It just wasn't what I, it was not my top priority. And mm-hmm. It feels like I'm just like waking up from this nap and I'm like, oh fuck, I forgot to care about the thing that I wanted.
Yeah. And like the grief that comes, because there's like the grief that comes with an unmet expectation or with, you know, oh, I thought my life was going to look different than this. And that could be in terms of career or finances or family, or, you know, there could be any area of life. And I also think culturally, we don't have space for that kind of grief. There's like, this is the plan and this is what it's supposed to look like. And if it doesn't look like that, then there's something wrong with you. And I mean, I felt my own degree of this in getting divorced. Like I felt so much relief in getting married. Just sort of that like, oh God, okay, yes, checkbox. Like I don't have to think about this really anymore. And like, I don't know that that was a conscious thought, but it definitely was part of it. Like I felt a sense of relief.
Yes.
And then in getting divorced, I was like, huh, okay. So am I back at square one? Do I have to like keep trying to like chase this thing? How do I grieve that? Like, and it honestly, I mean, obviously I'm doing an entire podcast called Should I Get Married Again, right? Like, do I want to do this? But there is so much grief of things not turning out the way that we have been sold that they're going to turn out.
Oh, God. I mean, and when you're, what you're saying too, like, oh, God, because there's this whole other dimension, right? Of like a thing that's not even mine, which is I'm the single friend, you know? I'm still the single friend. I'm the friend that's never been married. And so that is not my doing, but it is absolutely my identity. And I feel like it's this almost like infantilizing thing that follows me into, you know, like friends up here. I had this thing happen like a couple of months ago where like friends of mine up here all got together over dinner without me because it was a fucking couple's dinner. And I found out about it later and I was just like, that felt infantilizing, right? Like just like you do not, you have not earned your entry here. And so when you say checking the box, like, I get that. And I almost feel like, I wonder if I would, if I had checked that, like, because part of what I feel like compels me to want to be in partnership is almost just to like have that box checked, because I think that for women, right, like so much of our value for so long has been tied up in, you know, whether or not we can reproduce or be good wives, you know, mm-hmm. and that there's like almost this like, it's just, she's weird because she didn't figure that one out, you know, she's
and also
bereft.
Like how infuriating that there's such a narrow way. I was going to say to avoid criticism, but I don't know that we ever as women avoid criticism. But it's like, is it better to be the perpetually single one? Right? Like societally, right? Like that's seen as a failure, but getting divorced and having your marriage fail, like that's a fail. Like it's all.
Yeah. Which is the better failure?
Can we just live, actually? Like, I don't know. Like,
but I would rather be a divorcee because I feel like I could at least say, well, like somebody, you know, like somewhere along the line, you know, somebody wanted me, you know, or I figured that part out of my, you know, of my social contract.
When you talked about that dinner party, one of the things that I was going to ask you is what has your experience been of like other people's couple privilege or like what you see
couple
as couple
privilege?
Yeah, couple privilege.
Yeah. I mean, well, couple privilege is huge because like, first of all, I live in an area where it's pretty, you know, like I live in a rural area, and that means, you know, a lot of things. It means sump pumps. It means, you know, and like figuring out your propane. It means keeping your yard up. It means getting plowing service. It means like, and this is not stuff that like I'm saying like, oh, I wish I had a man to do this. It's more of, I wish I had a partner to do this. And I wish that like all the things that I have to consider and think about, it's kind of like high resistance living in that. Like there's a lot to do to like make it work and make it go around. And I think that like, so that's just one. I went to a breakfast and everyone there, like, I didn't take a COVID test before I went to it. And like I was just thinking about this, that the couples there all had done that and they like had their supply of COVID tests. And I'm just like, well, that's because there's two of you to fucking go online and figure like this yeah. out, you know, yeah. like there's two of you to split up these fucking, like life is so hard to figure out between taxes and utilities or whatever the fuck it is we have to do. And I think there's that piece of it. But I also think it's just in, you know, up here especially, I live in the Hudson Valley and very few single women move up here on, mm-hmm. you know, into cabins by themselves. So there's not like a single scene to begin with. And there's definitely not like a single lady scene. And I think that like all of my friends are in partnerships. And mm-hmm. so it's just harder. It's just, you don't get invited to the fucking couple things. Like, and that's supposed to make sense. And I'm sure it does, but it's just like, fuck. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I mean,
I'm bitter. Like, I've been up here for years in COVID, and I am like bitter about that part of like it is just, it, you know, like a couple is a pod, a single is not. And there's so much single privilege. Like there is so much. Or like parent, you know, like I don't have kids. And so I don't want to just be like, this sucks. But I think like, I've lived in cities my whole life, and there are so many single people in cities. Mm-hmm. And here, I just didn't realize, I think, how much of a, you know, an entrance fee there is.
Yeah. I mean, I also think that you're naming something that's important that often goes unsaid is a lot of the conversations about, you know, having a partner or being married or being in a couple is this like kind of romantic love story aspect of it, which of course is relevant, but the logistical things that you're naming, like how much easier it is logistically and financially oftentimes to split your life with somebody else, right? Like yeah. whether it's, like you said, like dealing with the propane or whatever, just like the tasks of life. Like I've thought about that, like this winter just personally for me has been quite hard and like low capacity and not great mental health time. And the amount of times that my partner has handled dinner. Like there have been a couple of like just instances like that where, you know, and it could be a housemate that like that type of logistical stuff, to your point from earlier, you can share your life with, you know, other people in a very committed and non-romantic way. There are certainly other ways to get those needs met, but yeah. our culture is built assuming that you are going to have that person to take care yeah. of you.
Yeah. And I think, like, I would say there have been periods of my life in the past couple, well, the past couple of years where, like, almost 90% of my desire to be in a relationship is just to have somebody, like, you know, fucking help. Like, to just help do things. That has been, you know, like, over, like, just the loneliness. And it is real. Our society is very much set up to reward those that are in partnership, mm-hmm. and most in heterosexual partnership, you know? And so, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned at the beginning in your introduction being newly out. How does that factor into kind of where you're at right now and how you're feeling about, you know, dating or potential partnership?
Not a lot. I think that I just recently finished Angela Chen's book on asexuality, and it's really interesting because it's, I think it's a book everyone should read, but she is, you know, asexuality runs on a spectrum. And I think one of the points that she really drives home is this idea of, like, the gold star asexual, you know, the one that never masturbates, the one that never has sex, the one that never watches porn, and, like, really fits this, like, tight definition of asexuality. And doesn't allow for there to be, like, spectrum or fluidity. And I think what was so refreshing about that, and I think the hardest thing about being out, is this idea that now that I'm out, I, you know, need now only, like, to, like, be in this really comfortable, almost gold star state of being queer. And I don't even know what my preference is. I don't know if it's pansexual or if it's bisexual. I've barely had a chance to even, you know, experience it or test it out. I've had one relationship. And for me, the only complication of it is thinking that, like, now that I am out, I owe more queerness. I, you know, that it's like some violation of, like, my desire to still want to be in a hetero relationship or a relationship with a man. And so I think that, like, right now, it is really hard for me to wrap my mind around, like, first of all, dating up here is just hard. And I haven't had enough of an experience, like, dating women or other genders, you know, women or non-binary genders, to, like, figure out what I I can't pattern match from, like, and I've only dated men. And so I know what I want in men. And
you have so much more data.
There's so much more data, so it's easier if I'm using the internet to, like, kind of, I'm pretty good at typifying people that way, but I have no idea what I want. So I think that, like, and it's just already hard up here. And so, and also I just really have a desire to be in with a man right now. And I think that that has been hard because it feels like I'm not really gay. And I think that, like, that's the only complication, is this idea that I need to prove something in my dating, but I know it's not real. I know that is performance over reality. And so I'm okay just mostly, you know, I'm so open to dating women, but also I don't know how to do it, and I'm not going to fucking pressure myself into figuring it out. And also I'm going with what feels, you know, what I've been conditioned to do my whole life, which is one of, like, literally I have a date today. It's a man, a cis man. He's coming over to my house and he's going to help me mulch my yard. And, like, and I know this is not things that just men do, but I still want a handyman. He's a woodworker. I still want that. I still, like, want this idea. And my ex-girlfriend, like, they fit that same bill, right? They fit that idea of, like, I know how to, like, fix all the tech in the house, and I know how to fix the door, and I can, you know, like, tune a piano. And so I think still in my mind, it naturally falls to that. So I don't know what I'm even saying anymore, but, like, it has only added a layer of, like, more pressure on myself to, like, figure something out that I haven't figured out yet, I guess.
Or to get to a finish line of identity and to, like, be able to say, this is exactly who I am. This is exactly what I want. Okay, check. I appreciate very much your honesty around that. I think that it's rare that people are honest in real time, like, when they're still figuring something out. I think that it's a lot easier and more comfortable to talk about something once you can put, like, a neat bow on it. And yeah, having to,
yeah, like, that, like, sigh.
No, but I mean, right? But, like, having to grapple with, you know, we're talking about the larger expectations of, you know, you thought you would be a wife, you thought you would be a mom, you know, at this point or whatever. And those expectations, and then combined with a, you know, I don't know, should we call it a sexual awakening, right? Or like something.
Yeah. Or like a real, like being able to, because it was like, it was not even awakening because nothing changed in my desire. It was just a, I think it was more of the conditions that allowed for me to acknowledge I didn't know I was gay. I never gave myself permission to do it. Anyway, but I think awakening, it wasn't like I just desired. It was just like I was just not really in touch.
But that's what I was going to say. Like how much of, as we continue to widen what we see as possible and valid in terms of relationships, mm-hmm. in terms of desire, in terms of ways of being, it does permission us to explore within ourselves things that for any number of reasons, whether it was like cultural judgment or childhood shame or any number of things, like didn't seem possible before. And so it's like, I think, and my, so I didn't realize I was going to talk about this today, but I am also grappling with realizing that I'm not straight, like in the last couple of months, which has been like a very, honestly, like very fun self-exploration. I haven't talked about it publicly before. So apparently this is my coming out podcast. No, but I resonate so much with what you just said of like not knowing, you know, like I'm gravitating more towards bi, like bisexual seems like it fits me better. But are these words that I can claim after a lifetime of like thinking I was straight-ish mostly, right? And coupled
with— Or straight privilege.
Right, exactly. And being in monogamous partnership with a cishet man that I'm not expecting to change, right?
Yeah.
And so it's like, does it even matter, right? Like, does it even matter? And the difference, what I am feeling is there is a gap between what I intellectually believe about this or like what I would tell someone else versus the emotional embodied experience of permissioning myself to like step into this identity in a way where what does it mean to claim an identity if you're not really changing your behaviors?
Yeah. And I mean, I can't speak on behalf of like the, you know, the LGBTQIA community, but I can tell you what a lot of my queer friends have told me over many years of having this conversation, which is it's okay to be a little gay, Holly, or you are valid. Your choices are valid. Your identity is valid. Like it is all valid. And I think that for me personally, I can say the thing I grappled with the most was because I have a gay father, because I have, you know, a very, very large number of queer friends who I'm very protective over and value what most of them who can't straight pass or who have identified from a really young age as queer and had to deal with the repercussions of that and still have to deal with the repercussions of that, dangerous things and limiting things and painful things. And I think that for me, it was really hard because I so didn't want to just take this identity without paying my dues or having or knowing exactly. But that's what I'm getting at with what Angela Chen said and why I thought that was just such a freeing thing, which is that you are allowed, like you're allowed to be fluid. You're allowed to come and go. It doesn't like claiming an identity or at least like exploring a different identity, I don't believe invalidates other people's identity who have had a different experience than you. And I think that like as gender fluidity and, you know, and also like orientation fluidity, like I just think these things are starting to, I think that what changed my entire perception of my own sexuality, and I think what was so important to read about, I'm not ace or asexual, I'm allosexual or allo. And, but at the same time, reading of the experience of somebody who is asexual has given me permission to not be so constrained by compulsive sexuality and our ideas around sexuality. And so I think that that is what is so beautiful about creating the conditions for people to be who they are and for people to change, which means that those that are out and on any spectrum are permission givers to those of us who, you know, maybe have more subtle spectrums or, so I don't know if I'm saying this right or not.
No, that's incredibly well said. I'd love to talk more about this book because it sounds like it was really impactful for you. Will you share a little bit more specifically, like Were there things you realized about yourself, or like what were kind of the self-reflection takeaways for you?
Well, I think it was, you know, first of all, I didn't know anything about, so we're talking about Angela Chen's book, What Asexuality Reveals About Desire, Society, and the Meaning of Sex. And so for me, prior to reading this book, I could not have explained what asexuality is other than an organism that has sex with itself, right? Which I think is, it's just a term I never thought to look into, even though it's right there at the end of LGBTQI. A, right? And so it's a sexual orientation, and essentially an asexual, it can mean many different things, but it's somebody who does, you know, like, I feel like I'm going to butcher this. I'm going to try my best, but I encourage everybody to read this book. It's defined so well within it, but somebody that is asexual is somebody that just is not, their life is not, like, sex is not a priority to them. They, you know, may not at like want sex at all. They may not ever have sex, but they may engage in sex, but it's not a primary drive. It's just like, I think one of the ways that she puts it is, you know, it's just like, maybe you don't like bread and sometimes you eat bread, right? Like, it's just, it is a way that, it's a thing that I think is not discussed enough. And so for a lot of us, for me included, I never really understood it as a sexual orientation, nor did I understand like what the implications of it were, right? When you hear asexual, you think of like agender, which is just genderless. Well, I think that that's a really good way to put it, which is just like, to a degree, it's just a, like a negates, right? So asexual, not sexual. And another topic that she goes into in the book is about aromanticism, which is like, you know, not romantic. And so I think for me reading this, so I have never really, I think probably because my early exposure to sex, a lot of my early sex was a lot of dick sucking, and it was in high school, and it was in response to my dad being gay and being afraid that I was gay myself, and also like wanting male validation and male approval, and, you know, just like wanting in a very, very, you know, misguided approach to it. And, you know, all my sex was drunk. Prior to getting sober, and I think even in sobriety, there have been times where I've absolutely enjoyed sex, but I can be a very sexual person. I'm definitely not asexual in that. Sex is a drive for me. It is something that motivates me, but I rarely enjoy it, and I'm not as motivated by it. And I think that that's always felt like either, you know, and I think like when I've even talked to doctors about it, it's like, is something off? Do you have a low sex drive? Is there something wrong with your libido? Do you have a nutritional deficiency? In relationships, right? Like this idea that like, if you're not having sex, then you're not, like that sex is such an important part of a relationship. And that if you're not, and usually the one that wants it, you know, like in my last two relationships, it was a problem. You know, my ex-girlfriend asked me if I missed dick because I couldn't orgasm. And my ex-boyfriend, you know, used to throw fucking tantrums when I just didn't want it. Like there was something wrong with him. And I think that in both cases, those were wrong things. Mm-hmm. I just didn't want sex. And this idea that was so freeing in this book, along like for there's so like everyone should read it because I think it goes into so many things. Like Angela wrote it, you know, not just for an asexual audience. She wrote it for everybody because we are all, I think, essentially, we're all shackled in a way by society's expectations of the dominant expectations of who we are supposed to be. And anybody that actually does not fall within that, any minority, right, that exists is also essentially normalizing, or not normalizing, but calling attention to the structures that are in place that are actually suffocating all of us. Mm-hmm. And to me, reading this was like, oh my God. Like, first of all, I completely identified with it. And I identified so much with feeling like there was something wrong with me because I've had friends, like I was talking to one of my friends the other day, and she was saying something about having, you know, sex with hundreds of people or something. And that's just so foreign to me, and not in a way where like, how could she? It's more of like, how come I can't, you know? And I think that we normalize that, like, it's, I have always had friends that like where sex was just easy. They just somehow go out and get it, you know, and they enjoy it when they do it. And like it's, and that has never been me. I just for some reason have not figured out how to fucking just go out and get fucked. I wish I could. Like, I wish I could be that kind of person that just had a lot of sex and was like, oops, did it again, you know, or whatever. I am not that person. I don't have that much sex. It is very hard for me to get there. And not only that, like even when I'm in relationship and it's just there for me, it's not what I want the most out of my partnerships. Mm-hmm. And I absolutely want passion. I absolutely do want like really good sex. Like I love having an orgasm. I masturbate, you know, whatever, but it's not up there for me. It's very low on the list of things. Right.
You're not building your life around it. Yeah.
So I could go on, but I'm just kind of curious of like, as I'm talking about this stuff, is any of it like hitting you or
No, I mean, okay. Completely. I mean, we live in a culture that is like simultaneously sex obsessed and like purity obsessed, right?
Yeah.
That like, you know, and there's no way that that doesn't have implications on everyone. And so much of what I have had to unlearn as an adult was the slut shaming of my younger years that I was subjected to, that I was participating in, that I did to myself, right? All of these things. Like for me, it sounds like my experience is different than yours in that I feel like sex, I wouldn't say that I'm sex obsessed, but it's definitely really important to me. And it's been really healing to let that be true. Like a lot of my internal stories was like, what's wrong with you that this is so important, right? Like we're given, and I know, I feel like in this conversation, we've oversimplified and like generalized a lot, but that like the generalized perspective that I was given is like, women aren't supposed to feel that way. That's how men feel, right? That like sex is really important, or that sex is a thing that you might want outside of like a deeply in love relationship. And so for me, a lot of the experiences that I wanted to have, I could only have them drunk, right? And so that was sort of my like, get out of jail free card, or like your drunk pass or whatever. And like so much of my drinking was drinking more and more and more to give myself permission to do things that I wanted to do anyway, right? And so I'm now almost 11 years sober, and it's been really interesting to kind of have to step back and be like, huh, how do I want to do things differently now? What in the realm of sex is actually important to me versus, you know, when you said high school was just a bunch of dick sucking, right? Like for validation or whatever, like that's so relatable to me. Like what were the times in my past that I thought that I really wanted sex, but actually what I wanted was to be chosen and I wanted approval. And if I was willing to do those things, then I got chosen, right? Like it's all so wrapped up. There's like so many threads that are knotted. And I feel like getting curious about this, and again, not expecting there to be a finish line, but just perpetual curiosity and exploration has been a much more self-compassionate way for me to approach this kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, and I think what's so interesting, what you just said, what I found fascinating about it is here we are, kind of polar opposites, or at least like the other, you know, the opposite ends of the spectrum, right? And we both think we're terrible people because of what we naturally want, or that there's something wrong with us because of what we naturally want. For me, when I meet someone like you, that feels like you have figured out something that I should have figured out, how to want sex, and that it's some kind of pathology, and that there's just like, I had some experience that made me this way. And I think that was another piece of the book that made it so helpful. So can I, let me digress. There's one other thing she talked about that I thought was so fascinating. And when people identify as asexual, right, there is often the question of, are you sure? Maybe you just had this experience that made you this way. Maybe you haven't found the right person yet. And when I read that, I immediately was like, no, it's just how some people are, because I closely identify with it, right? Again, not asexual, but like very, very close to identifying with what it must feel like because of so many different lived experiences. But I'm very romantic, as we talked about very early on. And aromanticism is this lack of feeling a romantic connection to a partner. And you might still be like very into sex and have a high sex drive, but that's just not a thing. And when I read about that, my first thought was like, well, maybe they just haven't had, you know, met the right person yet, or, you know, like, and that's just how they are. And so I think that in this, what was so thought-provoking about it was I just, like, I've tried to kind of pull apart why am I the way I am when it comes to sex? And thinking that something happened to me instead of letting it just be who I am and how I am and how I operate. And I think that, again, like, that has been really relieving. It's just how I am. And I think, like, I don't understand you. Like, I don't understand that. I've never understood it because I've never lived it or experienced it. Mm-hmm. And I think it's so hard sometimes for us to really understand someone else's experience when it's so far from our own.
Yeah.
But to me, yours has always felt like the one I should be. That I should be.
It's so interesting. No, it's, I mean, listen, that's why I made that. Like, I like making this podcast and I like podcasting as a medium because I think that there's something that we can get to in these like long, meandering, honest story sharing conversations that we just like can't get in an Instagram caption or in like any kind of a soundbite thing that like it creates so much freedom for me to hear other people talk about what's true for them, whether or not it's true for me. And here, like, it obviously feels really good when someone says something that you relate to that makes you feel less alone. That's its own special kind of feeling. But I think that it's equally valuable to hear someone say something where you're like, oh, huh, like, I don't know what that feels like, because it almost expands for me the fact that, oh, well, what else don't I know about? Or what, like, it just takes anything that can take us out of that really narrow relationship escalator, checkbox, checkbox, this is what you have to do to be like okay and worthy in the world. Like anything that can blow that apart, even by like one more inch, I feel like is so worthwhile.
Well, because we're so egocentric and like all of us are, we just mm-hmm. naturally like see things and we believe our worldview and our feelings, our beliefs are the right ones or like the natural ones or whatever it is. And I think that like it is really satisfying to be able to realize someone can experience the world so entirely different, like so entirely different. Anyway, yeah, I agree. I think it's great. And also, can we just go back to the part where you came out?
Oh, yeah, sure. Sure, we can go back to that. Yeah. What do you want to talk about?
I mean, no, it's just a really big deal. I mean, it's a really big deal. I just want to honor it. And, you know.
Thank you. Yeah, I feel very excited. It's been really sweet to have lots of conversations, you know, with the people that are close to me. And, you know, like you described, of having a lot of close queer friends, that's my situation as well. And it's just been so nice how everyone's been like, welcome. And,
yeah,
you know,
I know
have
my
things
friend,
to say about that.
My friend Valentine sent me a huge bouquet of flowers, and it was from, it was like, well, it said, welcome the gays. And it had no name on it. And it took me forever to figure out who it came from because they denied it at first. But yeah, I mean, it was like, it was so welcoming and so beautiful. But also, I think two people's work who really helped me, Marley Grace, they've talked about this many times. Their conversations around it helped. And then also Tracy Murphy, they also talk about this. And they were two really influential people whose work helped me to figure out my own sexuality. Mm-hmm. So
I feel like you and I could start the Marley Grace fan club because I very much agree. Yeah, very agree. Mm-hmm. Love Marley. Yeah, it's, you know, and what you said before about wanting to figure out why you're like this, right? Mm-hmm. Like I think that there is such a, especially those of us that are more, you know, self-exploration or self-help oriented, whatever you want to call it, that have that desire to look inward and ask those questions. I think that there's so much about that that's wonderful. And I've really had to check myself though, that like there is a point at which that is like, I weaponize that against myself, where it's like, not everything has to be pathologized. Not everything came from some like catalyst incident, right? That I like want things to make sense and to like understand why I am the way I am in so many different capacities. And like, sometimes that's worthwhile, but sometimes it's just, okay, well, I'm just like this. Like, can I just be actually? Like, can I not have to turn over every single rock?
I fully understand that. And I think it's, to me, it is a gift. And then it also is like a gift to know when to just accept that this is how I am, this is who I am, this is what I do, this is how I live. And both are, you know, they both have their place in time.
Well, and the end of all of those sentences for me would be right now. Like, this is who I am right now. This is how I live right now. This is how I want, what I want right now. Because if I look back on any I was like 5 year, 10 year period of my life. And the like, oh my God, things have changed so much. Like they've just changed so much. So it's so cute that I think that like the past was full of so many twisting turns and possibilities, but I think that the future has to be fixed. Like that doesn't make any sense. Like, it, you know, and it's, you know, with the sexuality and sexual identity and like that exploration process, obviously, part of it for me was putting together some pieces for my past and exposure to, you know, people's work like Marley, like you talked about, people like you who, you know, are coming out, even if they don't know the words that they're using, right? It's been like so many things put together that I think have opened up the space for me to look at this. But I will name something else that has been really useful that I never could have predicted is, so my partner and I, on and off for the last, since September 2020, have lived with his dad. Right? Like periods of time living in our vans, traveling, but then, you know, for most of the pandemic, living in a house with his dad, where especially when you're kind of quarantined at home together, there's not a lot of privacy, right? And sex is something that's been kind of a foundational part of our relationship from the beginning. Wanting to be sex and adventure partners was like really a lot of what drew us together. And then living in circumstances where that wasn't really possible. And kind of grappling with what does that mean? And I feel like it was only over this past winter that we were like, you know what? These are just the circumstances. We're going to stop fighting against them. And what if we just downgrade the importance of sex in our life right now and trust that when our circumstances change, when we, you know, move in together into our own place, that this connection is still going to be there and we can kind of nurture it in other ways. And it was a really interesting experiment because something shifted for me. I don't know if this is making sense, but something shifted for me being in monogamous partnership where we are not really having sex created a circumstance that I've never been in before. Because like in periods of time of being single, I was like looking for a partner, right? Or like out there or dating or sleeping with people or do like, it was always this thing that was like on my mind that I like had to do or a box that I had to check or validation that I wanted or an itch that I wanted to scratch. And like something opened up for me when I had all of this sexual energy like inside, but didn't have anywhere to really put it. Mm-hmm. That it, like, I started to notice, like, who am I feeling attracted to? Whether it's like people I follow on Instagram or like what porn am I watching or what, like any of these different things, and realizing like, oh, like none of it is straight, right? Like it like opened up a space for like that I don't think would have been there had I been in my like usual hamster wheel of like, gotta find a partner, gotta find sex. Like, yeah. I don't know if that makes sense, but it was really interesting to see that like that is part of what came out of it was like actually not having sex and like opening up that space without it feeling like a problem or like I had to meet someone else. Let me like put the energy into something different.
It is. And you know, it makes me think of, have you ever heard of Brahmacharya? Mm-mm. So it's one of the yamas, which are one of the, like part of the Eightfold Path to enlightenment. And the yamas are the five restraints or like the regulating behaviors or whatever you want to call them. But anyway, Brahmacharya is like it's basically not being loose with your sexual energy. And it's tied to creativity. It's interesting because like, so this is Hinduism. This is, you know, this is yogic essentially. And it's interesting because, you know, I learned this years and years ago, like controlling my, you know, I didn't masturbate for like a year. And like, to me, like controlling my sexual energy meant like, you know, like basically not letting it spill out the bottom of me and containing it. And like, if you contain it, you know, essentially like you can kind of, hopefully I haven't lost everyone. And I'm also not slaughtering this because it's been years since I talked about it. But like the idea is your sexuality lives at your second chakra. That's kind of like close to, it's around your sexual organs. And like basically if you can imagine it, like you either let it, like your sexual energy like fall out the bottom of you, like, or you're, you know, you waste it, or you keep it in and basically crank it up and like shoot it up, you know, through your higher chakras, and that allows you basically to access creativity. And so anyway, it makes me think of this because when I learned about that, I was so absolutely, I mean, I just like, it made sense to me. Like, mm-hmm. like, and it like, it truly does make sense to me. Like the Eightfold Path makes sense to me. And like the yamas are amazing, like ahimsa, and like there's like, you know, truth telling and nonviolence and all sorts of really practical, you know, principles to live. But it also is one of these things that I think about, like containing our sexual energy. Like these things were created, you know, really for male privilege, right? Like this is any spiritual tradition that exists today was created to purify male privilege, right? Those that were having sex or that were driven by sex are more likely to be driven by sex. And so like when you were talking about it, it made me think of like, I've kind of rolled back, I think, on thinking, on believing fully that like principles like this apply to the entire population of people based, mm-hmm. you know, just because of like different lived experiences and who these were created for. But then also when you're saying this, I do think it's interesting that like the withholding of sex, whatever, like, or at least like sex as you knew it, you know, turned, like opened up a different mm-hmm. portal of creativity.
Yeah.
Or, you know, desire that you didn't know existed.
Anyway. Well, and it's like, what is possible for us if we do something different than what we've always done? Like something's going to happen, right? And that I am finding myself really interested in that. I want to ask, when we were emailing, whatever it was last week, a couple weeks ago about this episode, and you said, quote, "I want to talk about almost 10 years of singleness, about wanting to have a partner and feeling like I'm missing out so much by not having one, but also knowing I'm not ready and that this alone time is precious." I wanted to ask you about the not ready piece. What do you mean by that? Like what would make you ready?
Well, I think, you know, what would make me ready? Look, I think that I know a lot of different people that have been in recovery. And there are some people, and I've just envied them, right, that just immediately have a partner that comes in at this period of time. And I know a lot of people for whom it seems very easy to be in committed relationships. And I think that, again, for me, it has felt like, to some degree, it's interesting, like I'm not, it's my energy, it's my vibe. I'm not manifesting. I'm not like doing the right things. I, you know, whatever it is, like I have wanted and wanted and wanted and felt many times along the way, I am ready for this. Like, where is this person? I am so tired of this bullshit. Like, why do I have to go through the hardest years of my fucking life and do it alone without somebody here to like just tuck me in or make me coffee or like just help me carrying the fucking groceries? I don't know. And I think like it was just like that morning I was trying to tell you about, like where I mentioned earlier, like I went to a brunch up the street and it was two couples and, you know, I didn't have a COVID test and I'm just like sitting there and I'm just like the fucking one that's like wearing their mask and everyone there had done their COVID test in plenty of time and had plenty of COVID tests. And I'm just like, I just like, it was one of those moments where I just wanted to fucking vaporize, right? Because it is sometimes so painful to not have your person, to be the single one, to be whatever. And so I think like that I have gone for 10 years in between this, you know, where is this person and this feeling of like an extreme deficit. And then also at the same time, where I am today, in this time, I wrote a book. I got sober. I got, you know, I overcame bulimia. I overcame alcohol addiction. I overcame drug addiction. I, you know, got out of, you know, six figures of debt. I bought my first home. I started a company and left that company. Started two podcasts. You know, I've written, you know, hundreds of thousands of words. You know, I've moved multiple times. I, you know, it's just like I got into gardening. You know, stuff has happened in my life. I'm so different. And I think that like there was no room to a degree, especially with the building of the company, right? And doing this thing that I felt very compelled to do. And like it was written in the stars for me and more important to me at the time than a family or a relationship. And let me just be so clear on that. I would have chosen if a person and kids were standing physically in front of me and creating Tempest was standing and writing the book was at another, was on, you know, if I had to choose between the two and I could hold them in my hands, I would have still, even now, how everything has turned out, I would still have chosen what I chose. And I don't regret it, but at the same time, it doesn't mean that I haven't felt that there was something missing in my life. And actually, in August 2020, when I started the process of, you know, hiring a CEO to replace me and going through this process of changing my role there, I just blurted out to my friend one day talking on the phone, like, it was one of my advisors, not even a friend, well, a friend and an advisor. And I said, I want a partner and I want kids. And I didn't even think about it. It was just what came out. And then, so from there, it was just like, well, now this person should come in. I've made these choices. And that was August 2020. And it's now, that's a year and a half ago. And it's, and there still hasn't been, you know, and still, and it's been a really, really hard couple of years. And still, I don't think I was ready. And by that, I mean that I think there is some work we can do with partners. And I think and that's different for every single person. Some people do their work in relationships.
That's me.
And some people, yes. And some people do not. And this work that I have done, it's been a solo mission. And that is not, I'm not guessing it. And I'm not like retroactively painting a story over something like building, you know, I'm not explaining, you know, by putting the story in place to explain it. I'm just saying, I know now, having gone through what I've gone through and experienced what I've experienced and being where I'm at, that anybody in my space during this time, especially this last year, when I wanted to die, when I didn't want to get out of bed, when I couldn't understand why I was alive or like what the point of my existence was, when I was bankrupt of like any sort of creativity or desire, when I was just napping, you know, through my life and just kind of waiting, there was so much I would have missed if I had been in a relationship because it would have been such a distraction for me and I wouldn't have done this work. And so that's it. I think it's like, I have wanted so badly, almost single-pointedly, like neurotically, to have a person, my person, my love story. I want it. And also, I've made decisions that did not prioritize that. And also, I have had the most fucking wild and beautiful decade. And I wouldn't change a thing. And I think that really goes to show me, you know, today, still single, right? Like still without this person, that like when I go into that, oh, it should be different. I'm missing. I just remember being in Rome for like 2.5 months and texting with this guy that I was fucking the whole time back in the United States. And just like thinking of like how much he consumed my thoughts on that trip, to the detriment of me being there and experiencing it. And I'm not enough here in this moment experiencing this. And it's just like wasting my life because I'm obsessed with a future outcome or some future thing. And like, this isn't enough. And I think that like, I've had to consistently remind myself, this is enough. You being the sad girl without the COVID test at the brunch, you're not getting to the fucking couples party. You're feeling like this is enough and it's great and it's perfect. And it's not a mistake or a detour. It's just like your timing and it's your life experience. And I have tried, Nick, like I deserve like all the awards for how much effort I put into trying to get into a relationship. The hours of therapy, the like fucking books, you know, like calling in the one, or like the exercises or the journaling, or, you know, Melody, whatever, I've read all of that shit. All of the couple people, every person that like got into a relationship and now is a relationship guru because they fucking did it. Oh, I've read all of their stuff. Oh, those people are the worst.
I can do it, so you can too. I mean, that's not a formula that, like, not just in relationships, that's not a great formula, right? Like, just because you were able to do it actually doesn't mean that it's replicable by other people.
Well, it's just like, I mean, it's just one of those things where you could have been, like, the most desperate person, but somehow you landed somebody and now you have, like, and now you're going to show us how, like, and I think, like, it's just timing. A lot of times it's just, like, it's such a personal experience. And, like, believe me, if, like, you can if you can vibe your way, or like if you could vibrate your way into a fucking relationship, I would have done that by now.
Oh my God.
You can't do it. You can't vibe shift your way into a relationship or manifest it, you know? And I'm so, I believe in manifestation and all this stuff, but I think that sometimes that's a really, really like mean trick. Because to someone like me who's done all the things and had all the affirmations and all the positive thoughts and, you know, who's done the – I fucking did the – like there's this like 30-minute Kundalini chant that you do for 40 days. The – oh, God, what is it? The Sukpur. It doesn't even matter. I've done it all, you know, and like yeah. still alone. And part of this has just been I'm enough here on my own. And if I die tomorrow, I'll have had a good life. A great life. And I think that is the that's a gift that I only got to because it didn't work out the way I wanted it to work out. That feels like a gift to be so in love with what's right in front of me and not dependent upon the possibility.
Yeah. And not making yourself say stay stuck in this I'll be happy when like where you're like withholding like all joy. The joy from yourself, like where you're withholding joy and pleasure and like self-esteem and all of this stuff from yourself until you reach some arbitrarily decided point in the future.
That's right. That's right. And I think like what is so fascinating to me and what has been such a like a tremendous value has been, I think like the work we do on ourselves the most comes from how we relate to other people. And like that's all people, right? That's our family, that's our friends, that's our partners. And I think that one of the biggest misconceptions I think is like that we can't do partner work when we don't have a partner. But I think that I've done more partner work, you know, on my own. Like meaning I think I have done more work on intimate relationships without one. Or at least just as valid work not being in a relationship than like as if I had been in one.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It makes complete sense. I was just going to say, I don't know if my response is going to make sense, but let's try. I think that sometimes if in any area of your life you meet the like normative expectation that in a lot of ways you can use it as some kind of a like – shield for like not doing the work. Like I think about this in regard to sobriety for me, that it's like I have spent a lot of time in the past like being angry about, you know, why is my relationship with this thing not something that I can just do like quote normally, right? Like mm-hmm. that I can't just drink normally, right? Or whatever mm-hmm. that is. And mm-hmm. so much of who I am and what I love about myself and what gave me self-esteem and like basically everything that's good in my life came on the other side of having to do that work. So it's like, I think there is some parallel to what you're saying that if relationships or whatever partnership or whatever was this like easy Disney princess story, like would you have gotten as far in sort of like a self-actualization way, right? Like, I don't know. There's like something, there's something to this. And like, it's like at the same time that I'm saying that, I don't want to glamorize the things that make us feel like we're suffering, right?
Yeah. Or diminish what happens when you do get what you want, because I think exactly. that work is just as important, right? Like
exactly.
you said, you do your work in relationships. And my work isn't like better because I did it, right. you know, the hard way.
But I mean, this is all like the best example of the both and. Like there's yeah. so much nuance here. And I yeah. think that we want to boil it down to this is the right way. This is the best way, you know, or even the stories of like, well, you can't be like happy in relationship until you're totally happy on your own. And like yeah. that has not been my experience at all as
no.
someone who does a lot of their work
or
in relationship.
Or you can't love somebody until you love yourself or truly love someone until you yeah. love yourself, which is such a myth.
Like anything that puts us in a linear, you must do this, and then you get to this, and then you arrive here. I'm like skeptical of all of that, honestly. Like,
yeah.
I think it's all really messy.
Yeah.
I think there's no one way to do it. I think there's no right way to do it. I think times in my life where I have felt like that was true was mostly just me trying to make myself feel better, right? Like, it's all yeah. this like beautiful clusterfuck.
Yeah, it is. And I think like the thing I have to continuously go back to is that it, like, the point of this is to experience it. Like, our point of existing and living is just to experience it, is not to like make something of it. And I think that like the just experiencing it is how you make something of it, right? Which is just being here for it and not having to turn it into something else or not having to have it work out in this specific way. And that, like, you know, like this last year again of like, and we talked about this on the last podcast together, but like just, you know, I was a CEO of a company and then I, you know, changed my role and then I got pushed out of the company and I spent a year in total grief and confusion. And I wanted it to be over so much. And I think that there was, and I was alone in the woods most of the time. And like, I just felt like, and like, we're still in pandemic. And I just felt like kind of cratered in this weird space in the world, like so far removed from so much of it. And I hated my house. I hated where I lived. I hated my life for a lot of it. Like, I just didn't want it. I felt like such a fuck up. And I remember one night I was just standing on my back porch and I was like from going through that and just living through that, there was just this shift. And I was like, oh, it's enough. Yeah. Like, oh, this is enough. Like, it's enough if this is just it. This house is enough. My life is enough. Even if I have nothing to show ever again for like my, you know, the air I breathe, this right here is perfect and it's enough. And I think that that has been a really hard thing to grasp. And I don't think I would have grasped it had I not been in such a like protracted period of feeling like my life didn't matter.
Yeah. No, that, I mean, that repeated phrasing of that, you know, this is enough and this idea that the experience is the point. I actually find that really comforting.
Yeah, because it just can be about this. Like this right now, you and me doing this.
Right. Like this is the point. It doesn't have to lead anywhere. It doesn't have to, yeah.
Turn into some like value later. It doesn't have to be the best podcast you ever did. It doesn't have to like save anyone's life. It doesn't have to be great art. We could just sit here and talk to each other and have fun. And this could be the point of like actually being alive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Last fall, I was in Asheville, North Carolina, hosting a retreat. And I went into this small art shop and I bought a little print there that it's just like really simple. It's got kind of a picture of like a crystal prism on it. And it says, "May I experience this completely?" And I feel like that has been my touchstone ever since. Like, may I experience this completely? And I will tell you, when things feel hard, like, I don't want to experience it. I want to avoid it. I want to get out of it. Like, I don't want to be there. I don't, you know, and just like, okay, like, this is what's happening. Like, can I experience this completely? And sometimes the answer is no, but I think about it all the time.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think that's a really beautiful way to put it.
Is there anything that we haven't talked about that you wanted to bring up?
No, I mean, I feel like we really covered it all. I mean, like, do I want to get married? We haven't talked about marriage.
Sure, let's do that. Yeah, let's do that. Do you want to get married?
Yeah. I mean, I've listened to a lot of your episodes, and I think, like, I mean, marriage is a trash institution, you know? Like, of course it is. And, you know, like, it's, I think that there is so much about it that I fundamentally disagree with. And yes, I want to get married. Mm-hmm. And I think that is part of, it's less about I want a certificate. I mean, I still want the trappings. Believe me, I want to wear, I do, like there's still a part of me, and we're being honest here, right? So there's still a part of me, like, I will never be a mother. I don't think I will. But I, you know, it's so stupid. But like, I've been watching, you know, like This Is Us and Chrissy Metz, like her character is mothered, you know? Like she became a mother. Do you watch This Is Us?
I watched I think the first like season or so.
All right, doesn't matter. But basically this character on screen, it's just like she reminds me like of all the women I know that have had kids. And there's just like a thing that I feel happens to women that have children and or a thing that happens to women that get married or whatever it is. And I think like I still am bought in that is a missing part of my puzzle. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that So, you know, like if I'm talking to, this is like such an almost anti-feminist thing to say, right? Which is like, I believe I should have children and get married because that will make me more of a woman in my own eyes and in society's eyes. So I'm acknowledging that sentiment is against my politics. And at the same time, I cannot also argue with the fact that it feels like a thing I want for myself and a thing that I feel is missing. And again, die tomorrow, fine. I'm happy with my life. I'm happy with what I've done. I'm happy with what I've accomplished here. I also believe in multiple lives. I don't think this is it, you know? And also, I feel in this lifetime a longing for something that feels like it has something to do with those two things.
Yeah.
And I don't know how to pull those two things apart, and I don't think I have to.
Yeah.
And
I mean, that's I feel like the through line of this conversation is nuance and both and just allowing it all to be true at the same time.
Yeah. So yeah, I do. I do. I want to get married. I want a partner. I want a forever thing. And I'm not interested in polyamory. I'm not interested in, you know, for me, it's just, it makes, and it's just, I'm simple, and I want like a person to do this life with. And I think another beautiful part of Angela Chen's work is talking about, you know, a lot of times these types of things, they can be satisfied through like friendship, you know, deep committed friendship. And I think that like the spectrum of what I'm looking for is not my wild love story, even though I want that very much so. But I'm also, it's like 50-50. I want the love story, but I really want companionship and committed companionship.
Yeah.
And, you know, I want a person whose back will have mine and whose back I'll have.
Yeah. I think that's a very beautifully honest place to wrap up. If you could leave people with an affirmation of sorts based on our conversation, what would that be? Like, what's your wish for everyone listening? Besides to read that book, because that's our homework.
I think my wish is we just don't have that much time, you know? And when I look around and what's happening in the world, it's just like we don't have that much time. We should know that by now, that our lives are so short anyway, and the world is changing rapidly, and what we prioritize and how we use our time counts and it matters. And so much of it, I think, is used to, like, so much of it is like mental processing of what we should be doing for everything. And I think that like we can have it all right now if we just allow ourselves to actually invest in what we value.
Yeah.
That's not an affirmation.
No, but it's excellent nonetheless. What's the best place for people to say hi to you?
You can find me on Instagram, and my handle is just @Holly, H-O-L-L-Y, or you can also find me on Substack. I write a newsletter called The Recovering.
An excellent newsletter that I highly recommend.
Thank you. Yeah, I've got to write mine today. I'm going to go on a date, and then I'm going to write this fucking newsletter. Yeah, and I don't know the web address for it. I think it's like Substack.
I'll put it in the show notes. Don't
worry. Okay, cool. Thank you. But you can just Google Recovering Holly Whitaker and you can find it.
I love it. Holly,
I love
you.
So much.
I love you too. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks so much for listening to this very first season of the Pop-Up Pod. All of the intimate and honest conversations you'll hear on this show are 100% listener-funded, paid for by my sliding scale Patreon community. That means no ads and no sponsors, just a couple hundred people coming together to ensure that everyone involved in making this podcast gets paid. That includes me as the host and creator, my sound engineer and musician, Adam Day, as well as every single one of our guests. The Patreon community also funds the creation of a full transcript for each episode, which you can find in the show notes to help make these conversations more accessible for all. Those are our production ethics here at the Pop-Up Pod. And if that aligns with your own values, I would love to invite you to come check out our community at patreon.com/NicoleAntoinette. It's a fun, easy, and welcoming space. You also get access to lots of bonuses. And remember, it's run on a sliding scale, so you can pay whatever amount makes most sense for you each month, depending on your circumstances. That's patreon.com/NicoleAntoinette. And hopefully, I'll see you there.